Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Welcome along, everybody, to episode 6 of the Drive Nation podcast. I'm Dan Prosser. On the other end of the line, as always, is Andrew Frankel. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. Dan, how are you?
Yeah, very well. How are you? I suspect, like me, Andrew, you've not been doing a great deal of work and you haven't been driving anything.
I'm soldiering on. We are trying to do lots of different things with Drive Nation, which some of which will already become apparent, many more of which will become apparent in the days and weeks to come. So although there's not much of the traditional kind of work, I'm not completely bored to death just yet.
No, same. Okay, well, we've got this podcast to keep us busy. And this week, we're talking about the art of road testing cars. I think if you're being charitable, you'd say that recording a podcast on the subject of your own profession is reflective or introspective, but maybe it's just navel-gazing. A few people...
Profoundly self-indulgent.
One of those. A few people, though, have asked us to talk about road testing on this podcast, so hopefully they at least will enjoy listening. I say the art of road testing cars because it can be a tricky thing to quantify, which is why it's worth talking about, although the truth is there's some objective science to it as well. Andrew, I've been assessing and reviewing cars for almost 12 years now. How long have you been going?
Just the 20 years longer than you.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
Yeah, 32. So I started my working life as a road tester, a junior road test assistant on auto car, the day after Jaguar won Le Mans in 1988, a race I was at. And so I turned up at auto car's offices on the Monday morning, not only ready for my new life, but also sporting the most colossal of hangovers.
And you've been pursuing that sort of level of professionalism ever since, have you?
Relentlessly, yes.
Okay, so between us, we have, what's that, 44 years or so of road testing experience. So hopefully something worthwhile to say on the matter. Now, the car magazine road test, as we know it today, was invented actually by Auto Car magazine in 1928. You weren't quite at Auto Car then, Andrew.
No, I was elsewhere at the time.
Elsewhere at the time. So the term road test tends to refer to the very thorough assessment of an individual car, and it'll be published in a magazine over several pages with independent objective data as well as subjective assessment, and often with a lap time recorded as well. But for the sake of this podcast, we're talking more broadly about the discipline of assessing and reviewing a car or cars as a piece of consumer advice. So, Andrew, you've mentioned already that you first started reviewing cars for Autocar 32 years ago. Can you tell us who you learnt to assess a car from and how you sort of built up the skill set that it takes?
Yeah, I turned up at Autocar thinking I already knew how to do it because I could drive, and obviously you always think you know it all. It was a much more drawn-out, protracted process than I ever imagined it would be. I mean, really, it was with the guys who were doing auto cars road testing at the time. My boss was a bloke called Howard Lees. And Howard was an amazing bloke. He very sadly died in a stunt plane accident shortly after he left Autocar. But, you know, certainly the business of, you know, how to, for instance, extract a set of performance figures from a car, which is not quite as straightforward as it might sound, how to operate all the equipment, how to drive fast safely on public roads, because obviously when you're off group testing, as you'll know just as well as me, you tend to get from one place to the other fairly rapidly. And if you start pinging things off the scenery, you're not going to have a job for very long. So really, it was you know, there was no... I mean, I was given a lot of help on the writing side, but that's probably another conversation. As far as the mechanics of road testing aside, literally, it was just through experience. I had no mechanical knowledge. I still don't, really. You know, I could just about change a set of brake pads. That's about it. So it was just a question of being out there with the Autocar road test team and learning on the hoof, which then is now, I'm sure, remains the best way to do it.
You touched on it there. I think later on, in a separate episode of the podcast, we'll talk about the business of car journalism sort of more broadly, and we'll talk about some of the fun that we've had over the years, maybe some of the funnier incidents, more memorable cars that we've tested. We'll talk about the here and now of car journalism, the future of it as well. For this episode, though, we really are focusing specifically on assessing a car. It seems to many people like it would be a dream job. It was to me, which is why I worked so hard to get into this industry. I also know how much fun I've had doing this job over the years, road testing cars. I know also as well, though, how frustrating it can be at times. So, Andrew, do you think it's the dream job that people assume it is? Is it really all it's cracked up to be?
It's so easy, isn't it, to sort of portray yourself as, you know, as someone who's actually had, you know, a much tougher time, and it's nothing like as much fun as it's made out to be, and all that. but the truth is, it kind of is. The only proviso I would add in is if you're the right sort of person, if you have the slightly strange skill set that you need to be able to do it, and if you have, you know, you need a lot of energy, you need a lot of enthusiasm, because, you know, it's, you know, as you know, it's not a 9-to-5 job. It's kind of the opposite of a 9-to-5 job. You quite often you're driving all day, but then writing all night. And if you don't like that, if that doesn't really get you up and going in the morning, then it's the wrong thing to do. Also, you know, it's not something that, unless, you know, you end up doing it on telly, is ever going to make you particularly rich. But no, it is. Let's be honest, it's a fabulous way of earning a living, even if it's not a very enormous one.
It was interesting there, Andrew. You touched on this idea that you'll be driving all day and then writing all evening. I want to talk to you about how road testing cars has changed over the years. It's changed even in the time that I've been doing it. When I started in the very end of 2007, Even then, car magazines didn't have websites the way that they do now. Certainly not very busy, very active editorial websites that we're used to today. And so I think I've got this perhaps slightly romanticized memory of it being a much slower pace back in 08, 09. Less of a rush to publish your verdicts immediately. But has it always been the case, Andrew, that you've been up against deadline, that you've always had to turn around copy more quickly than you would like to? Or was there a time where you could, you know, take your time over it and sort of stew on it first?
Certainly working for a weekly like Autocar, there was, you know, there really wasn't much time for, there was rarely much time for, you know, a huge amount of reflection, because even if, you know, technically speaking, the story didn't have to be in the magazine by a certain date, you know, you always had people back in the office who couldn't work. They couldn't do their jobs unless they had your words. And, you know, you weren't the only person writing for the magazine in any given week, and they had to space things out. So, you know, if you went and you drove a car, you know, the expectation was that you would provide the words pretty promptly thereafter. That said, it's nothing like it is today, where, you know, with websites which are, you know, which have these insatiable appetites, and, you know, and magazines and publishers have this this incredible imperative, which I'm not sure how important it actually is, but to be first, to be, you know, first in print. It's almost a pride thing that, you know, the Autocar will always want to be first to any story. Particularly if that means beating, for instance, Auto Express to it. And I get that, and it's always been that way. But yeah, you know, we are. But again, you know, I'm not necessarily complaining about that, because to me, it's part of being good at the job. You should be able to drive a car, come to a conclusion about that car while you're driving it, and fairly shortly thereafter be able to, you know, summon a reasonably coherent set of thoughts, get them down on paper, and you know, I'm getting published. I think that's, you know, that's just part of the job these days.
I completely agree. We'll come on to the skill set required to do it effectively and well in a moment. But let's go back to this idea of how it's changed over the years. I mean, back in when you first started, were you being flown to all corners of Europe and to the Middle East or to North America to drive?
Yeah, we were. I mean, not if you're very junior, but actually the press trips back then were far more lavish than they are, much more lavish than they are now. I mean, I can remember there was, I think Renault, I didn't go on it, but there was one press trip to the Yemen. There was, you know, you get press trips where manufacturers would reach the end of their budgetary year and realize they still had a huge amount of money in the pot, and they'd just ring up some of their mates and they'd just fly them off around the world doing stuff on the slimmest of pretexts, just because they could, and they knew that if they didn't spend all their budget for this year, then their budget for next year would be smaller. So, you know, all that stuff used to go on. I mean, the very first launch I went on was the Alfa Romeo 164, which involved, we drove the cars from England down to the south of France. On the way down, we stayed in the Trianon Palace, which was the bit of the Palace of Versailles, I think, which Louis XIV built for his girlfriend. And then we went down. I got caught for speeding. Alfa Romeo paid the speeding ticket, which no other manufacturer has ever done in the 32 years I've been doing it since. And then we were flown home on a private jet. And I can just remember fiddling around trying to find my life jacket under my seat and finding a drinks cabinet instead. They clearly thought it was altogether more important that you could have a nice gin and tonic on your way home than, you know, something to put around your neck if the plane should go down. So I kind of thought, I've arrived. This is it. This is just how I'm going to spend the rest of my life. And of course, it doesn't quite work out like that. And as you know, very well indeed, most of these press trips are fairly straightforward events. You know, you go to an airport, you get on, you know, a scheduled aircraft, usually in the back of it, and you go to, you know, a destination, hopefully get in the cars because they're at the airport, drive them, go to a press conference, have a bit of dinner, write your story, go home in the morning and do the next one.
Yeah, it's difficult to talk about this stuff without sounding horribly spoiled, but
that's because we are horribly spoiled, Dan.
That's why it's so difficult. But yeah, even in the time I've been doing it, so just over a decade, that stuff has really changed. I remember when I first started, it was all chartered planes from private terminals, Farnborough or the Harrods Aviation Terminal at, that's at Luton, that one, isn't it? And amazing hotels. Now it's very different. Often you're still staying in a nice hotel, but you're, yeah, as you suggested, you're on normal flights at the back of the plane. And I think that's, I don't have a problem with it. I mean, it's nice to fly in a smaller plane, perhaps on the BMW corporate jet, as I did one time. But, you know, it's no big deal. You're actually there to do a job.
The only time it is a big deal, and I make this point, and I hope there's some manufacturers listening, although actually almost all manufacturers are very good in this regard, is that if you are flying long distance, so you're going to the States or the Far East or wherever, just from the pure business of, you know, being able to make such trips, which generally take many, many days, pay their way, it's important that you are, A, that you arrive in a fit state to drive a car, because that's just a simple safety matter, but also, you know, I have to be able to work all the way there and all the way back again, otherwise I just can't, justify being away and not earning for that amount of time. So, some space around you to be able to do that is kind of important, but I agree, on all sort of local European jobs, then, you know, it's not such an issue.
No, exactly. You're quite right to say that. What I was building up to was that there was another aspect of, perhaps we're getting into car journalism a bit more than road testing here. We'll switch back in a moment, but there's another aspect of...
Are you about to talk about the Blag?
How did you know?
I can see it sort of lumbering over the horizon. So clearly your time did coincide with the days of the Blag.
Just about.
Yes. So what was your Blag policy? And what was the best blag you were ever offered?
Well, okay, so I was 20...
You should probably explain what a blag is at this stage.
Yeah, well, the manufacturer wouldn't call it a blag, of course.
What would they call it?
I think a gift.
Yes. Yes, possibly. Something to help you understand their product a little better.
Yeah, so sometimes...
Which you can take home with you and consider in your own time.
Exactly, and yeah, and enjoy at your leisure. So I often... It really doesn't happen now. If you know, you might get a model of the car that you've gone on the launch of, which, if it's a special car, that's worth keeping. But it used to be the case that it was every launch that you went on, you'd walk into your hotel room or on the charter plane, you'd be handed something, and it was a gift, and it was something to keep, often something quite valuable. I think the most sort of remarkable one I ever received was an iPod Touch when they were brand new. Back in 2008 or something.
Honda Accord launch.
Honda Accord launch.
Yes.
Exactly.
Not that
right.
I still have that Touch.
Yeah, I think I got rid of mine at some point. And I don't really want to confess this, but I got rid of it in returns for some money. So
here's a question. I know the answer to this question, but I genuinely think people will be interested. Do you... did you ever feel in any way awkward or embarrassed about taking these things? And do you think it ever affected anything that you read about the car that you were there to test?
It's no to both. It is no to both, but I completely understand why people feel that accepting these gifts compromises your independence and your ability to critically assess this car the way that you should do. And that's why... It doesn't tend to happen anymore, and frankly, I couldn't care less for that reason.
Yeah, no, it's back in the day, I mean, you know, this was actually before my time, but some of the stories you used to hear, because even when I got into it, it wasn't exactly dime, but the size of the gifts were getting a little smaller. I mean, there's one I can remember, again, only by the stories that I heard, that there were a bunch of journos who went off on one of these junkets, and they came back and they discovered that someone had not only delivered a brand new fridge freezer to their house, but stocked it as well, which is fairly astonishing. But yes, as you say, it's almost entirely disappeared now, and I think probably and definitely for the best.
Yeah, quite agree. Okay, well, let's get back to how road testing has changed over the years. I mean, do you think, like, cars clearly are very different now compared to 30 years ago. Has that changed the process?
No, I think what's changed the process more than anything else is the equipment that we use to measure, to get the data. I mean, I just missed, thank God, the era of the fifth wheel. You may have seen photographs of these bicycle wheels bouncing up and down behind cars, which, you know, my predecessors used to have to strap to the side of cars, and they were, you know, infernally unreliable, difficult things. When I joined, we had a thing called a Datron Korovit, which was made by Lights, and it was basically a sensor and a light which you stuck to the side of the car, and it shone a light on the road, and the sensor picked up data. It was a big, heavy box, which you really kind of needed someone next to you to hang on to, because if anything ever went wrong, that was an awful lot of metal which would start flying around the cabin. And even that was a very, very flawed bit of equipment. It was flawed because if it was wet, it couldn't cope with the reflections off the tarmac. It was flawed because it did all sorts of things to the aerodynamics of the car, which means you couldn't do a maximum speed run. It was flawed because it had to be a certain distance off the ground. And if you strapped it to the back of a car like a TVR, which had very soft rear suspension to get maximum traction, as you went off the line, the car sank down. The sensor got closer to the ground, and it was you get insane readings. It was flawed because it would come off. It was flawed because it required a flat surface. It was a horrible piece of equipment. But obviously these days, I don't go figuring cars these days, but, you know, you would probably be able to explain much better the sort of V-Box equipment that people use today.
Yeah, V-Box, so it's GPS-based. It's a little device that you stick in the windscreen, and often it'll have an aerial that you attach by a magnet to the roof of the car, and it measures it by GPS. And something, they can be a little bit glitchy, but when they're working properly, they just make the task so much more straightforward.
And can you see sitting in the car? For instance, let's say you're recording, I don't know, not 100 times. Can you see exactly there and then what you've done, or do you have to then download it to a computer and only then get to see what the car's been doing?
You can see it there and then, and more recently, you can see it on your phone. There are apps, I think, that will do it, but to get the best readings, you need the actual GPS unit, but that can attach to your phone, so you can see in real time. You know, you'll have a 0-60 figure in mind, and you'll know as soon as it flashes up. If you're aiming for something beginning with a 3, as soon as it flashes up with a 4, you'll just bail out of that run, and then go again.
Yeah. We had to do the run and then hit whatever it was you hit, and it would then literally just print out onto tape the run, and that was the only way that you'd know. Whether you'd had a decent crack at it or not.
That's hilarious. So you suggested, Andrew, that the process of testing cars hasn't changed that much as the cars have developed, but surely the process of getting objective straight line and lap time data has changed, given that cars have perhaps become more reliable, a bit tougher,
Yeah, faster. That side of things has changed, enormously. I think, again, I don't road test these cars. I go out and I drive cars and I assess cars, but my days of spending, 2-3 days a week at Millbrook just pounding around the up and down the mile straight and around the speed bowl are many years behind me. But yes, I don't hear stories of cars going pop in the way that they used to. When I was road test editor of Autocar, we lost so many man hours trying to recover stranded road testers because whatever they were in it, they'd been in had gone bang somewhere, that I mandated that no one could go to a test track without somebody else with them. We always tested effectively 2 up. But often they're just, it was not practical to have 2 people there. So so we had ballast bottles that we put 75 kilos of in the car so that it would make up for the weight of the absent passenger. But in the end, we were just, Saabs in particular, they were just, I think that most of the times I went to a test track with a Saab, it broke. There were Saab 900s, which broke their gearboxes. I think there were 9000s, which if you did a standing start, the engine would move so much the distributor would come up and thump the underside of the bonnet, and that was that. I had a you won't remember this, but there was a type of there was a Jaguar tuner called Chasseur, and they came up with a twin turbocharged XJ6, which I was driving down the mile straight at 140 miles an hour or so when a sparrow came through the grill. And on its way from the grill to the bulkhead, took out so much wiring and piping that it completely immobilized the car. I guess that sort of thing could still happen today, but mainly it was transmissions, it was half shafts, it was gearboxes, engines occasionally, things just were nothing like us road. But and also, almost all the cars we were figuring at the time were manual. And so you had to, there was no traction control, there was no launch control. You just had to, rev them up and sideset the clutch and hope that it all, held together.
Talk me through the process of extracting straight line acceleration data from a four-wheel drive manual car 15, 20, 25 years ago.
That was kind of, that's what you really didn't want. unless it was wet, because... a four-wheel drive car, back then, they wouldn't have anything like as much power as, you wouldn't have been able to light up all four wheels. Mm. And so there was effectively no limit to the amount of traction you could have, which basically meant you had to rev it to the red line because, you wanted to get the car off the line as fast as you possibly could. And that's the way the numbers were extracted. And you did that and you held your breath because... the clutch often would just, incinerate itself. The wheel spin was much, much kinder to the car. The moment the wheel started spinning, then nothing else within the drive line would, and your clutch wouldn't, burn itself out. So it was just a question of getting off the line as best you could. If it was a turbocharged car, that made life even more difficult because, you had to make sure that somehow you stayed, you kept the turbo spinning properly. And then you'd just be up through the gears, changing gears. I mean, people used to think that the way to change gears was just to, you know, yank the lever as hard as you possibly could. But, you know, each gearbox, you know, you had to learn each gearbox of each car. And, you know, there were some which would tolerate that. And there are others which actually would give you a faster shift if you were a bit gentler with it, because, you know, because they wouldn't balk. You know, some cars back then didn't even have rev limiters. So if you missed a gear and just landed back on the gas, you could just blow the engine up. So it was a fairly fraught process. And I don't think any of us liked figuring cars like that.
Yeah, and it's amazing how that compares to nowadays. So, for instance, you might be figuring a 911 turbo, PDK gearbox, launch control. It couldn't be more straightforward to activate the launch control, dial up... Well, you just flatten the accelerator and the system will choose the revs itself. And then you just lift your left foot off the brake pedal and the thing will rocket away from the line incredibly fast. And it'll do 2.8 to 62 or whatever it is, time and time and time again. You'll do it once and then you'll try it again just to see if it decides it wants to go any faster. And then that's it.
Yeah. You see, we had to do... And I think it's a very good point. I think that's another reason that cars broke. Because it was a difficult process, and often much more difficult with some cars than others, you know, sometimes you had to have go after go after go at it. And so, as you say, with launch control, you go one up, one down. So you've corrected for gradient and wind, mm-hmm. and then you go home. And there's actually precisely zero skill required. Whereas back then, you always had in your mind an idea of what you thought it should do because you had your manufacturer claims, maybe another magazine had done it and they got a certain time out of it. So you kind of knew what you were aiming for. And if it wasn't doing it, quite often you just conclude that you run out of talent. But you felt the need to keep on chipping away at it. Many's the time when cars broke on me when I just said to myself, I'll just do one more. And then it's on that last run that, you know, it just goes, come on, don't be silly. Packs up on you.
So it's difficult really, isn't it? Particularly with slightly more complicated cars that take a bit of skill to extract a time from. There is, all wrapped up in that, a degree of pride, which probably muddies the water, doesn't it, a little bit? You want to go back with a fast time. You don't want to go back and say, oh, it wasn't that quick.
No, and absolutely, you know, there were road tests. I mean, I wasn't the quickest, I don't think. I would always be within, you know, a tenth or so. But you build up a picture of your colleagues and there'd be certain people who, you know, would go up to the test track and they'd come back and, or worst of all, they'd be there with you and you'd each try, you'd swap positions and they go a tenth quicker than you. And that was never much fun. And you just sort of build up a picture. And, you know, I certainly ended up just trying to send people who I knew would be able to get the job done and come back with the numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the most important thing, really, isn't it? And hopefully without breaking a car. This is a sort of two-part question that I'm going to put to you now, Andrew. Presumably, to be a road tester, particularly when we're talking about the test track side of it, you need to be an enormously skillful driver. We all are clearly very, very talented, and we could have had F1 careers if only we had...
Lavishly endowed with talent.
So there we go. How much... skill, how much ability does it really take
to be a road tester?
Yeah.
As opposed to being distinct, it's a strange skill because it's not just the driving. I think that's the thing. You do have to be able to drive well. You do have to, I mean, even today, you have to understand what a car wants, how to drive it, how to get the most from it. It was harder back in my day, just because things were so much more analog than they are now, and the cars just didn't do things for you the way that they do today. But even so, you still have to be able to, you have to be safe, you know. Certainly more so now than when I first started doing it. You know, there are times when you are traveling at proper velocities, and sometimes you're not in a straight line, particularly if you're maxing stuff. The test tracks that we use, Myra and Millbrook, they're pretty old facilities. They don't have, acres and acres and acres of runoff area. And you need to be professional about it. You need to make sure that your tyres are in good condition. You need to make sure that the conditions are right. So, you know, you've got to have a fairly thorough approach. But then, you know, the other, I would say, more difficult skill of the road tester, which is, I think, as hard now as it ever was, is being able to actually understand what the car is saying, being able to just do that assessment, being able to work out where, you know, amongst its competitors it stands. Is it good or bad at this, that, or the other? And I think that that is, that is definitely the more difficult than the driving part of it. You know, there are lots and lots of people who could drive cars to the standard required to, you know, to conduct a perfectly passable road test. I think the number of people who could understand and interpret and communicate what those cars are saying to them is perhaps somewhat smaller.
Yeah, agreed. That is the better part of it, really. I think from a driving skill point of view, the key thing that I've sort of understood and learned over the years, partly from my own experience, but also from observing people who are more experienced than me, also less experienced than me, is that it's what you need in terms of ability at the wheel. It's a level that can be achieved on the job just by being diligent, working hard, listening to advice, observing the more experienced people around you. I don't think it's a level of skill that needs to be God-given that could otherwise have taken you into a motorsport career. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, from a driving point of view, absolutely. But you do have to be, you know, professional about it. I mean, if you think about, you know, you don't think about it because you do it, I was about to say every day, you don't do it at all at the moment, but when life is normal, you do it every day or certainly every week. But if you think about it, you get flown to somewhere you may never have been before, put on roads that you will never have driven on before and which have no relevance to the roads that the people who read what you write will have. You're given a car that you've never sat in before, and then you have never enough time. You may sometimes have, you know, as little as, I don't know, an hour and a half actually driving that car, because we have to share the cars with other journalists usually. During the course of that, you may well have to get an entire photo shoot done. And at the end of that, you are expected to come up with a reliable and, you know, often forthright verdict on that car. And, you know, I've never thought that was an easy thing to do. When I first started doing it, I was completely at sea. You know, and I would just kind of hope that I got it right. I didn't really understand at the time that, you know, that so much of it is not a question of right or wrong, but, you know, opinions that you can back up. But I do think it's difficult. But no, you don't need to be Lewis to do it. But, you know, you do need to have done your research, particularly understanding where the car sits in its class before you get in it. So you've looked up its rivals and you've done sort of basic specifications, and so you make life as easy for yourself as possible, and you know as much as you possibly can before you've sat in the car. To me, that is an absolute, you can't just, you know, just get into something blind, go and drive it and expect your verdicts to be reliable and sensible.
Yeah, well, you've preempted my next question there, because you're absolutely right to say that the task, the job of assessing a car, road testing a car, begins long before you actually sit in it, because you have to make sure you're very, very familiar with the technical specification, with the optional extras, particularly this day and age where there are very often optional extras that will fundamentally change the way the car drives. You need to know if the car you're driving has
100%. You look at cars like Mercedes A-Class, Ford Focus, Volkswagen Golf. You know, what their manufacturers aren't terribly good at telling you is that it's only the top spec cars, for instance, that have independent rear suspension. Yeah. And, you know, if you drive two hatchbacks identical, apart from the fact that one has a proper multi-link rear end and the other has just got a beam axle, the differences, and in these particular cases, are, you know, absolutely night and day. And surprise, surprise, you go to the launch, and which are the cars that they put you in? It's always the cars, you know, and I remember on the A-Class launch, the current A-Class launch, you know, whenever it was, a couple of years ago, going to the launch of that. And you know, Mercedes-Benz hadn't done a beam axle before. It was the first time they'd ever done that kind of suspension. And just saying to the engineers, well, you know, where are they? What, you know, this is such an important development for this car and for your company, and yet what are we meant to do? We're meant to take your word that it's just going to be just as good or fine or whatever. And yeah, so you're absolutely right. You know, the specification of the car that you're in, you know, so many cars, again, your air springs, you know, if a car has an air spring as an option, you know, the chances of it being on a press car that you're going to drive, 10 out of 10.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. Okay, so well, let's move it on a little bit. So you've done your research, you've worked out exactly what the car you're driving is, which bits of equipment it does have, what it doesn't have. Do you have a process that you tend to run through when you've sat in a car for a first time, or do you just drive and listen to what it's telling you?
it depends on the environment. If, for instance, a car comes to my house and I've got it for a couple of days and I can go out on roads that I know, that is one process which I can control completely. If, on the other hand, we're flown somewhere, I have to share a car, I have to do a photo shoot, time is limited, I don't know the roads, that is another process. In both cases, obviously, you do your research in advance. And then, yeah, when I'm on my own, you either have a dictaphone with you or a notebook and you sit down, because thoughts so often, particularly when you get to my immense age, come into your head and leave it again almost immediately. So it's important that, you know, if you do have an idea or you suddenly think, oh, hang on, this car's behaving in this particular way on that particular surface, that you remember that. So the answer to your question is there's the full range from, you know, fully comprehensive approach, you know, with written notes done over, you know, a period of time best measurable in days rather than hours, to just get in the car, drive it, and hope that your experience is sufficient for you to be able to do a decent job at the end of the day.
Experience, that is absolutely the right word, isn't it? I remember thinking that when you've been doing this job for 5 years, you're starting to get somewhere from an experience point of view.
Yeah, and it just depends how you're doing. I mean, if you are, you know, I autocar everything for all sorts of reasons. But, you know, in terms of the, can I call them skills that I've been able to develop? I guess so. being on a weekly car magazine where you are testing cars all the time, you know, you're going to learn four times faster than where you're on a monthly. You know, you're going to drive four times as many cars. You know, Autocar, you know, still today publishes easily the most comprehensive road test. And if you're up at the test track, you know, quite often in any given week, I would spend more time on a test track than I would in the office or on a road. You'd just be out there all the time. And that with that level of experience, because you're, you know, you drive. 50, 60,000 miles a year easily. You drive 120 to 140 different cars every year easily. And if you're doing that, you learn fast, particularly if you're, you know, if you're young and hungry as I was at the time.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think actually the weeklies are the best sort of training ground for young road testers. Andrew, we'll sort of break down road testing into its constituent parts in a moment, but I just want to touch on one other thing. I remember a few years ago, you and I were both going on a car launch. I think it was a Mercedes AMG GTC launch. I think it was in Arizona in the US. And you emailed me beforehand saying, do you want to share a car on a mutual no-scare basis?
Yes.
Can you tell me and the Drive Nation listeners why you had to add that last bit?
Because actually, the most important thing about any car launch is not the car that you're driving. It's not the story that you will write. It's that you emerge from it in the same number of pieces at which you went into it. You know, I am and always have been a terrible passenger, but there are good reasons why you want to know well in advance who you're going to be sharing a car with.
Yeah.
I have a friend, a man called Gordon Cruikshank, deputy editor of Motorsport magazine, who 30 years ago was on a launch in the passenger seat of a car with the wrong person driving it. There was a terrible, terrible accident. The driver emerged unscathed. And Gordon, you know, will spend the rest of his life in a wheelchair as a result of that. And, you know, we sort of laugh and joke about it, but there is a serious side. There have been some enormous and, you know, and tragic occurrences on car launches. And, you know, I just, you know, there is a lot of testosterone around because, sadly, it is still a male-dominated industry. You know, sometimes you get in a car with a bloke who you don't know very well, and it's clear to you from the off that, and maybe because they know who you are, maybe because they know you've been doing it for a bit, that they've decided they want to show you how good they are. And, you know, to me, that's not relevant and that's not appropriate. And because I'm so tediously British and reserved about the whole thing, I find it very difficult. I mean, I have done it, but I find it very difficult to say, mate, you're being a bit of a twat. Would you mind just slowing down? And so what I tend to do these days is, you know, is find out, you know, first thing I'll do is I get invited on launch. I'll ring up the manufacturer and say, who else is going? I will then identify someone like yourself you know, who's not only a mate, but someone who's going to drive sensibly. And then, you know, if you do feel the need and the road is right and the condition is right to drive, you know, as fast as you feel safe and comfortable, but probably faster than your passenger would ever feel safe and comfortable, what do you do? It's very easy. You just stop at the side of the road, say, mate, I'm going to be gone for 20 minutes. I'm going to drive up and down this road, and then I'll come back and I'll stand by the side of the road, and then you can do it. And then you can get the job that you need done. Nobody gets scared. And if anybody gets hurt, it'll just be the bloody idiot behind the wheel.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think what I find myself saying to younger road testers just starting out is, do not concern yourself with trying to come away from a launch with a reputation for being a hot shoe. The most important thing is that you earn yourself a reputation for being a safe pair of hands, someone who can be trusted.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That is 100% correct. However, I would add, I'm not going to contradict you, but you know, you, from your reputation point of view, you have to be able to do the job. And particularly when we end up on racetracks, where you are usually on your own, you know, it's not important that you prove that you can do 200 yard skids. But okay, one example, I won't name names, but I will name one name, Jethro Bovingdon, because he happened to be in the car with me and he was as frustrated about this situation as I was. But Jethro and I, we were sharing a car at a test track in Germany, and it was one of those ones where you had to follow an instructor around the track, and because these were Porsches, the instructors, as you know, on Porsche launches drive like the wind, and you end up going faster than you probably would have done if you'd been on your own. But there was one bloke in our Ducks and Drakes convoy who was so slow that he couldn't keep up with the instructor on the slowing down lap.
I remember.
Because you're not allowed to overtake, you have to queue up behind this. And so you're sitting there trying to get your laps in or whatever. And you've got someone who, and, you know, and this person would have gone off and would have presumably told his readers, you know, how, you know, this car handled on the limit. And, you know, clearly having absolutely no idea of how to drive a car in that way. And it is a component of the job. People do want to know how cars behave when driven up to and over the limit. You do have to, in very controlled circumstances, be able to do that. And if you can't, if you want a job as a road tester, then you've either got to learn fast or probably find another way of earning a living.
Yeah, so it's safe pair of hands, but the truth of it is, particularly if you're driving a very fast car, as we all find ourselves doing these days in this line of work and on circuit as well, you do need to be able to drive it pretty close to its limit in order to have a say on what that car's actually like at that point. Andrew, let's sort of break it down a little bit. Is it fair to say that assessing a car is sort of 3/4 ride and handling?
It is, in terms of what is difficult about assessing a car. Because, you know, you and I and anybody else in the world can sit in the back of a car and work out whether it's got decent headroom or not. You know, that's not difficult. If you sit and you think about the way a car's interior is laid out, you can work out for yourself whether that's a good job has been done of that. It's when things are, there's nothing more subjective than ride and handling.
Yeah,
and there's no area of the whole road testing business that is more difficult than that. And so, although it may not make up 4/5 of your assessment in terms of the amount of time you spend thinking about it, absolutely, that takes up at least 4/5 of your mental space.
Mm. And how long is a piece of string? What do we mean by ride and handling? Should we see if we can break that down a little bit more and explain it?
No, after you, mate. It's an enormous subject. I mean, I've literally, you know, I've written entire stories on the subject of steering feel alone.
Yeah.
You know, handling is a subject that is so enormous that everything from its on limit oversteer understeer balance to the squidginess of the material they use to line the steering wheel, are factors. But I suppose ultimate handling is, to me, if you boil it down and boil it down and boil it down, it is a car's ability to execute the instructions of its driver.
Yeah.
Okay? You'd be amazed at how many cars don't actually go where you think you've pointed them. And you only have to go to a roundabout and drive around. You don't have to be on the limit or anywhere near it. Just drive around a roundabout with a with a constant steering input and see whether it's, you know, 360 degrees later, it's got back to where you started. And so that is handling at its most basic, essential form. But then beyond that, obviously, it goes into all sorts of other areas. And ride is, you know, is an even more, well, even more at least as subjective subject area. And people get tripped up by it all the time because they either mistake or fail to understand the differences between primary ride and secondary ride. And your primary ride is basically a car's ability to maintain its ride height. So, you know, a car with poor primary ride would go, it would feel light over crests and it would wallow around in dips. And it would fall over in corners and that sort of thing. Secondary ride is actually easier because it's lumps and bumps. It's just a car's ability to isolate, you know, sort of everyday imperfections you get in a road surface. But the problem is that quite often those two objectives of primary and secondary ride have been, you can tie a car down at springs really hard and get a fantastic primary ride, but then your secondary ride's going to go out the window. Likewise, you can make a car all lovely and soft and, you know, early Jaguar XJ like, and you can get the most beautiful secondary ride, but its primary ride will, you know, will be affected. So it's the job is judging not only how well it's been done, but how well it has been done for the kind of car that it is. So, you know, if you're testing an S-Class Mercedes, you're going to have rather different ways of measuring how well it's done that job than you would if you were testing, I don't know, a GT2 RS 911.
Yeah, exactly right. And it also, a car will feel very different on one surface compared to another and on a motorway compared to a B road. And you can, we know that it's an incredibly complicated and quite nebulous thing, ride and handling, because for decades, scores of very, very clever engineers have been beavering away at it, and even now get it wrong.
Oh, absolutely. And the development process of even, you know, a small volume car from a low volume manufacturer, you know, the chassis engineers will go through, I mean, the permutations, if you think about the springs, the dampers, the bars, the bushes, the geometry. And if you think of the number of combinations of all those things, and of course they can never, you know, change more than one thing at once, because then they won't know which particular change has made the, you know, that's why these cars take literally years to develop. And the tires as well, working with tire manufacturers to come up with exact constructions and exact compounds that work for you. It is the most and I feel sorry for them, because, you know, what happens is they spend years and years and years doing their absolute best, and then idiots like you and me get in a car on roads we don't know, and head off, and then an hour and a half later we either say fantastic or we write them off. And, you know, they must tear their hair out, and they must want to come up to you and, you know, shake us by the lapels and go, don't you understand how hard we worked on this and the pressures we're under and the constraints we had to work within? And, you know, and we just, you know, we have sadly all the power and none of the responsibility.
Yeah, it's true. But that does highlight why this job, this sounds self-important, why it's a necessary role, why we do need people independently driving these cars and saying, oh, I'm not sure that's any good. But I completely understand. I mean, and very often these engineers will be constrained either by time or by budget or by access to components. It might be that the accountants will only pay for a very cheap damper, for instance, and the engineers just have to work with it.
Yeah. And we don't know that. And no. They won't tell us that. It must be so frustrating for them. But, you know, at the end of the day, and without wishing to sound like a proper journalist or anything, you know, we have to report as we find. and if they come to us and they go, oh, well, you know, if you, you know, because quite often, again, you know, poor engineers, they can get stuffed by their own manufacturers because cars come to a launch and they're on, you know, they're on the biggest wheels with the smallest side wheels possible because some marketing department bod has decided that's what they're going to look best in the photographs. Or they go to some part of the world, which is completely inappropriate to putting that car through its paces because, again, it'll look good on the photograph, or because the chief executive wants to stay in this particular hotel. And all that work stands or falls on, you know, on the environment in which the car is presented. Who'd be a car engineer?
Environment in which the car is presented. That's a very good point, because that brings us on to the next part of this podcast. So I remember driving when the AMG, the Mercedes AMG GT was new. What was that? 2014, maybe 15. And they launched the car in California. And I remember collecting a car from San Francisco and driving it to meet an Evo magazine colleague. It was Jeffo, actually, who had a 911 Carrera from the launch, which was in LA. So we met halfway.
Can I just ask how many people listening to this are feeling sorry for you right now?
It was a little bit rainy. Does that help? Possibly not.
You poor lamb. Keep going. Sorry.
And it just so happened that kind of equidistant, where there were some good roads, took us to the junction where James Dean died, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Which is an aside. But anyway, I remember driving this AMG GT and being stunned by how capable it felt. And Jethro felt exactly the same way. And he was doing the twin test between the AMG GTS and the 911 Carrera GTS, which was the car being launched in LA. And Jethro gave the nod to the AMG. And then a few months later, we had the car in the UK. Mercedes took a car up to the Scottish borders for us, and we had all of its rivals. We had a 911 Turbo, a Nissan GTR, we had an Aston N430, a V8 Vantage N430, there's one other car, maybe an i8. So we had its rivals there. And we were all blown away by this AMG GT, and we thought it was a wonderful thing, and it won the group test. And a few months later on, we had that car at Car of the Year, so towards the end of the year, with all of the best cars of the previous 12 months or so. And the thing was a pig. This car that we'd really been bloody impressed by on two occasions beforehand. We were driving it again in Scotland, but somewhere else, a bit further north. And it just felt like a completely different car. And I remember being utterly sort of thrown by that, really confused, just wondering, what the hell's going on? Is it the context, among all these other perhaps more focused performance cars? Was it the roads we were driving it on? And I questioned everything that I had written and said about the AMG GT up until that point. So, Andrew, leads me on to the question. Have you ever felt like you've got a verdict wrong, or felt like you've had to change your opinion given further exposure to a car?
Yeah, I mean, similar sort of thing. I wouldn't say I've got a verdict wrong, not because I pretend for a moment to be brilliant or all-seeing or infallible in any way, but because a verdict is an opinion. And, you know, but have I ever felt I wish I hadn't written that opinion, and therefore I suppose, you know, that's a wrong, you know, as you can call it, I guess. Yeah, so a very similar sort of thing. One of the best launches I went on was the Aston Martin DB9 launch in, it would have been 2003, I'm guessing, south of France. Everything was just the way it should have been. So we got to the launch hotel very quickly. The launch hotel was literally on the Col de Vence. So, you know, you literally just get out of your, you drive out the gates of the hotel, turn left, and you're on an amazing road. So none of this fiddling through, you know, city streets or big long motorway sections. You could be out there doing your job, you know, from the get-go. And we just, I think 5 days earlier, I'd been in Maranello driving the 612 Scaglietti. I mean, it's staggering that two front engine 2+2 V12 coupes from, you know, blue bloods like those two could be launched within, you know, literally a few days of each other. But in fact, I think the original plan, I'm going slightly off piste here, but anyway, I think the original plan was that they'd be on the same day until one manufacturer or other realized that they'd only have half the journalists they'd intended on if they did that. So they literally moved the launch. I think Ferrari shifted to get the UK journalists in. Anyway, the DB9 was fantastic, and I can remember sharing with Gavin Green. Most of you will know Gavin, fabulous journalist, long-time editor of Car Magazine, old mate of mine, you know, very accomplished racing driver. And we just sat there with our smiles getting broader and broader and broader because, you know, we suddenly thought that, you know, Aston Martin, you know, its future had been secured with the DB7, but here was the DB9, you know, and to me it was just a way better car than the Ferrari for an awful lot less money. And that was fab. And then I drove it in the UK and it was just a different thing. Now, you know, I wasn't the only person to think this. I wasn't the only person to drive a DB9 in the UK and come to a very different conclusion to the one that they had in France. There were conspiracy theories about Aston Martin had very trick dampers on the cars that they used for the launch. You know, I know that manufacturers have played those sorts of games before. I'm not for a moment suggesting Aston Martin did then. All I'm saying is that people said that was the case. I wasn't one of them. But the car was different. It just didn't feel as nice. And, you know, that could have been, and it happens, literally the difference between smooth French roads and our legendarily rutted road network. I don't know, but yeah, I wish I hadn't been quite so effusive about the DB9 then, but in the circumstances in which I found it, you know, to go back to something I said a few minutes ago, I reported as I found.
Yeah, there you go. That's all you can really do ultimately, isn't it? Okay, well, we need to start winding this down in a moment, and we'll do that by talking very briefly about the future of road testing. To anyone who's tuned into this, sort of hoping for some advice about getting into road testing or car journalism, I think we'll address that later in a different episode when we actually definitely talk about car journalism more broadly.
We will. Sorry, we will definitely do that because... I did one of the Collecting Cars podcasts with Chris Harris, and we talked a bit about this. And the number of, you know, young enthusiasts who then got in touch with me, because I'd said on this podcast that, you know, I'd be keen to help people a bit. And of course, I then got flooded with requests, but it does seem to be something that people are very interested in. And it's not a straightforward subject. So not straightforward indeed that it really does need a podcast by itself and not something we can tack on the back of this one now.
Okay, so we'll address that later on. But before we finish up, Andrew, we've got 2 minutes or so to discuss the future of road testing. We're going to have to keep it brief. What are your thoughts? I mean, does it become less relevant or does it actually become more relevant as cars become more homogenous, electrified and so on?
No, I think it becomes more relevant. I think as, you know, there's this term, you know, which has been, you know, around the industry for as long as I've been in it, that there's no such thing as a bad car anymore. And I just hate it. I just absolutely hate it because any car exists in a class with other competitors and within that class, there will be an order. And if your car is the worst car in that class, it is, to me, by definition, a bad car. And we need people to make those calls. It'll get more difficult because, yes, of course, the gap between the best and the worst is narrowing, and it has been for a long time. So it may have got an awful lot easier to record a set of performance figures for a car, but I actually think the business of road testing, of reaching those crucial verdicts and telling people where these cars actually sit and the nuances and the distinctions between, you know, one car and another, I think it's become more difficult and I think it'll become more important. I think people always need to know what's best, what's worst, and yeah, and I think, you know, your computers will never be able to do that, and you need road testers, and, you know, good luck to them because it's a great life, but not one that's about to get any easier, I fear.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there we go. Let's begin to wrap it up then. So a few of you, dear listeners, you were good enough to send in some questions for us. We haven't asked them explicitly, but I did make sure that we had addressed as many as we could throughout the podcast. Although there was one for you, Andrew, just to finish things off. You can choose any one road in the world to assess a car tomorrow. Which one's it going to be?
Oh, do you know what? I'm going to give you the most boring answer. And it is, it's the road. It's actually a few roads, but it's my local, it's my testing route around here. It's not the road. So it basically goes from where I live in the Wye Valley, up to the Welsh mountains and back. It's a really, really good road, but it's not the greatest road in the world. But the reason I'd nominate it is because I know it inside out. And from a purely specifically road testing point of view, the fact that I can take that variable out means that I can reach a more reliable verdict on a car on that road than I can on any other. So it is actually, I think, the most important tool for a road tester to be able to have is somewhere they know they can go and drive a car. A road which has all the surface and camber changes and good combinations of corners, and then you learn it inside out, and then you have a sort of a datum point, something by which everything else can be judged. Mm-hmm. So I wish I could have said something rather more exotic, but no, it's a road between the Wye Valley and the Welsh Mountains.
I completely agree with you. Familiarity is key. Well, there we go, that's a good place to leave it. So we'll end it there. Thank you everybody for listening. Please remember to rate the podcast, leave a review, subscribe as well, wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you for listening. And thank you, Andrew, for your time as well.
Thank you, Dan. I look forward to doing it again this time next week.
Yeah, we'll speak to you soon. Goodbye, everyone.
Cheers. All the best.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.